I'm the dude. So that's what you call me.
Are you a virgin?
Yeah, not since I was 10.
Are you there, God? It's me, Margaret.
Come out to the coast. We get together, have a few laughs.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Can I return it if it doesn't fit?
It always fits. Eventually.
Welcome back to Movie Mingle. I'm Caveman.
And I'm Maggie.
And we are here on episode 50.
50!
50 episodes.
50 episodes. Honey, congratulations. This is so much more your doing than mine. You have kept us going through the 50 episodes. You've edited every single one and all the bonus episodes. You're the one that makes us watch the movies, makes us record. When I'm like, meh. Well done. Congratulations to you for 50 episodes. I'm so happy for us and proud of you.
Well, thank you. But I couldn't do it without you.
Me.
You are... I put it together, but you make it interesting.
That is true. The amount of times I make him roll his eyes and go, God damn it, Maggie, while we're recording is so much more than you hear, folks. So much more. We couldn't have done this if we didn't have the right partner, so... Thank you, and I love you.
I love you, too. Yay. And to celebrate our 50th episode,
shots.
Of course, we have shots of whiskey.
We have shots of whiskey. As our longtime listeners know, we do like to take a shot from time to time. So, to 50 episodes.
50 episodes.
To-do. Whiskey. Whew.
That is whiskey.
That is, yowzas, whiskey. If any whiskey companies... We would happily do Blanton's Presents Movie Mingle.
Blanton's?
Or, Knob Creek or...
Woodford Reserve.
Woodford Reserve.
Presents Movie Mingle.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Some, like, beautiful orchestrated score behind us. And then it's just you and me fucking up while drinking Woodford Reserve and talking about movies. God, that's what this movie should have been, or this podcast should have been. It should have been whiskey and movies.
Try different whiskey with each movie.
Yeah, with each movie we can.
Well, that's why we need sponsors.
That's why, yeah, we could not afford that. But anyways, here we are, 50 episodes, and what's the movie that we're going to talk about?
The movie that we're talking about is The Silence of the Lambs.
Wow.
From 1991, of course, starring Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins.
Robin. Producer Robin climbed onto my laptop and tried to close it on top of him like a blanket.
Like he just crawled in the bed.
Sir.
Well, this is a great start. It's a great start to episode 50.
I can't move the computer or him, although he is now looking up Hannibal Rising because he's a very curious man. No, Robin.
Yeah, The Silence of the Lambs from 1991. Directed by Jonathan Demme.
Yeah, it's Jonathan Demme.
Who also directed Philadelphia. And a couple episodes from the TV show The Killing on Netflix with Muriel Enos and Joel Kinnaman. And it takes place in Seattle.
Oh. So definitely wasn't filmed in Seattle. It would be worth watching. It was filmed
in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And you can tell it was filmed in Vancouver when the actress takes a ferry over to Whidbey Island, which they mentioned by name.
So she goes, okay, yeah.
She gets on a ferry, goes to Whidbey Island to investigate at a casino.
Okay.
Of which there are no casinos on Whidbey Island.
No, there are not.
But not only that, but the ferry that she took over.
Yeah.
Is not a Washington State ferry. It is definitely a Vancouver ferry.
See, you know what? Like, they always get things wrong about Seattle. This is going to be a fun tangent. This is going to be such a fun episode, you guys. I'm so excited for it. There's a movie called 10.5. It is
All right. Buckle up for this tangent.
A NBC produced and aired miniseries. It was two movies. So it was a little miniseries about what would happen if a 10.5 earthquake struck the West Coast. Now, keep in mind, it didn't strike Seattle. It struck all of the West Coast and mainly took part in LA because, of course. But the beginning of the series starts with a giant earthquake demolishing Seattle. I lived in Seattle at the time, or outside of it. And clearly, the producers didn't even Google what does Seattle look like. They had the Space Needle in the middle of town, in like a poor area of town. And then when the earthquake hit, the Space Needle fell. It literally crumbled like a shortbread cookie. It just was destroyed, even though the Space Needle is made of very thick and heavy metal. Like, very thick and heavy metal. And its support systems are really deep in the ground. But this fucking Space Needle,
they made it
crumbled like a biscuit.
They made it look as if it was made out of just 100% concrete.
Yeah. And, or biscuit dough. You know? And then the whole time, this, like, bike messenger is able to avoid the earthquake and all of its pitfalls because he's a badass on his bike. Until he gets smashed by the dome of the Space Needle. Anyways, it's amazing. Literally top five, one of my most favorite opening movie scenes ever. And I don't know why I started talking about this, but here we are.
Because of the killing on Netflix.
The killing, which, because of Jonathan Demme.
Yes, mm-hmm. Who directed a couple episodes.
I'm so sorry.
But is more known for Philadelphia and The Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah. I mean, he's done more than just that. Robin? No.
Yeah, he also directed The Manchurian Candidate, mm-hmm, with Denzel Washington.
That was a big movie. He was big in the 90s, wasn't he? Like 90s, early 2000s.
He seems to really be a huge music video director, because he has done a lot of Bruce Springsteen, a lot of Neil Young. The book, The Silence of the Lambs, was written by Thomas Harris, who wrote it in 1988. He wrote all four books, The Red Dragon, The Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal, and Hannibal Rising.
So I have read all of them but Hannibal Rising.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know you've read the first, or...
After Hannibal came out,
yeah.
I kind of had like a weird... Because it came out when I was a teenager. It was like, what, 2002, 2003, I think? And I had, I don't know, I had daddy issues and had a thing for older men at that time in my life. And so... I think I might have had, like, the tiniest little, like, Hannibal crush. But it made me deep dive. Because the Hannibal, the movie itself, is fucking great. The book is interesting, to say the least. The book definitely takes it in places that I don't agree with. And I think that the fandom overall doesn't necessarily agree with. Because, like, Clarice and Hannibal, like, fall into this romantic relationship, and she becomes a cannibal too, and it's a whole thing. It's very weird. So the movie, I think, is the better story, and I think collectively as a society we've agreed on that. But I did go through a minor obsession with the series, and so I watched the original Manhunter with William Peterson. And I think Brian Cox is Hannibal, right?
Yeah, Brian Cox. Yep.
And that
I've seen that one.
That is a great movie. They remade it into Red Dragon, and it's nearly a shot-for-shot remake.
They're
and
very similar.
It's just not as good.
Red Dragon?
Yeah.
I don't think Red Dragon is as good.
Good,
but I still enjoy watching it.
Yeah.
Mainly because I like Edward Norton,
yeah,
and I like... Because Anthony Hopkins...
Yeah, comes back.
Comes back for it.
But I'm telling you, man, like, Red Dragon is sexy. William Peterson is so hot.
Ralph Fiennes also. I love Ralph Fiennes as the villain.
I might have to rewatch it, because it's been a hot minute since I've seen either film. But anyways, so yeah, and then I think I read Hannibal first. And then I went back and read The Silence of the Lambs, and then maybe Red Dragon or Red Dragon. Either way, I have read three of the four books, and I have seen, well, I've seen three of the four movies. We'll talk about Hannibal Rising in a little bit. But although I sat in the theater and watched that film, I have not seen that film.
Next up, Ted Talley wrote the screenplay for Silence of the Lambs. He also wrote the screenplays for All the Pretty Horses, Mission to Mars, and the screenplay for the Red Dragon adaptation. So they not only brought back Anthony Hopkins, but they also got the original screenplay writer of Silence of the Lambs
for Red Dragon. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, that was sort of like the big thing too, is that like everybody was coming back to do the remake of Red Dragon, because since Manhunter had been made first and it flopped, they were like, oh, you know, nobody's going to care about Silence of the Lambs, which is why Orion was able to just make it for hella cheap. And, well, maybe not hella cheap, but they were able to swoop in and make it, because the original people that did Manhunter were like, fucking go ahead.
Pretty cheap movie.
Yeah.
Even for the 90s.
And so it was always like, if you looked at the trilogy, right, Manhunter, Silence of the Lambs, and Hannibal, Manhunter was the odd man out, which is why they remade it, called it Red Dragon, which is what the book's called, and the rest is history. I still prefer Manhunter, but just because it's the sexier movie. William Peterson at that age was really
William
hot.
William Peterson...
Still.
Well, I don't know about still. It's been a long time since I've seen him.
I'd look on my computer, but producer Robin has declared I don't get a computer this episode. So.
No, I love William Peterson, CSI.
Yeah.
I mean,
he was hot in that, too.
Yeah.
I really had a daddy thing when I was younger.
When you were younger?
Hey. Damn, called out on the 50th episode. Well, doesn't that make you happy?
That's what we do here.
Daddy.
Maybe not. Music, of course. We have to talk about the music because we talked about him last week when we talked about Seven. But Howard Shore composed the music for Silence of the Lambs as well.
Yeah, and I think this was the better soundtrack.
This was a very 90s soundtrack.
Yes.
Reminded me a lot of The Fugitive.
I don't know if I could tell. You know what? You've seen The Fugitive more times than I have. I think that you think of The Fugitive the way that I think of, like, this film. It's a movie that you're more likely to rewatch.
I really love Silence of the Lambs.
I saw The Fugitive as a child, and I've seen it once or twice since as an adult, and I don't care for it, mainly just because it bores me.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, it's so much fun.
I haven't seen it in so long, though.
Tommy Lee Jones makes The Fugitive a fun movie.
Yeah.
Harrison Ford makes it an interesting movie.
Yeah. The Fugitive is one of those films that, like, I recognize it for its value, but I just haven't seen it in so long that I don't care. Does that make sense?
Yeah. One day we'll rewatch it. Or I will. By myself.
But if you get high and watch Spice World with me, I'll get high and watch The Fugitive with you.
Howard Shore, of course, did the music for the Lord of the Rings trilogy and just so many, many amazing films over his career and my lifetime. Yeah, if you want to hear us gush more about Howard Shore, not only listen to our last week's episode when we did Seven, but our Lord of the Rings special that we did back in September?
September. I was just about to bring up the fact that Howard Shore did the opening song for The Rings of Power, and I don't think that fucking banger of a revisit to Middle Earth gets the love that it deserves, but it's amazing. Just saying, The Rings of Power theme song by Howard Shore, flawless return to Middle Earth. Did he do the Hobbit movies? I don't remember the music of the Hobbit movies, but I think he did.
Yes. Howard Shore did the Hobbit movies.
They are.
He doesn't lose points in my book for doing those.
I think the music was fine. The Return to the Shire was delightful.
There's nothing. I think the music, as far as that trilogy goes, is the least of the issues we all have with those movies.
I couldn't even watch fucking The Girls.
The first one.
I couldn't rewatch The Girls
The reaction of the two women we watch on YouTube.
I so literally didn't care.
Yeah, like, I was... We
deserve better Hobbit movies.
Isn't the same. Cinematography was done by Tak Fujimoto. He's been working since 1970 to about 2013. He's still alive, but, you know, hopefully happily retired. Mm-hmm. He worked on movies like Swing Shift, Pretty in Pink, Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh, wow.
Married to the Mob, Philadelphia, mm-hmm. Devil in a Blue Dress, That Thing You Do.
Oh.
The Sixth Sense.
Wow.
Signs. The Manchurian Candidate.
Interesting seeing how he connects with different directors.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of these movies are like the same.
Yeah, he's with these this director, and then he moves on to this director, and then he moves on to another director.
You know, good for him. All of those films are solid films that I don't necessarily think of the cinematography for, but I can't fault them in any way for.
I bet you could. Well, I mean, of course,
if I were to watch the comedies, each movie with the eye of the cinematographer, I might be able to see it.
Like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Pretty in Pink, and Married to the Mob
yeah.
might have a very specific
similar look,
to it.
Yeah.
You know, Philadelphia,
same with, like,
Devil
the
in a Blue Dress.
Signs.
That Thing You Do is a very specific kind of period piece mm-hmm. with a lot of things that make you think of the 60s.
Yeah.
So I would not compare that to any of the other movies on the list as far as the way that it looks. Because The Sixth Sense and Signs, you could say, kind of
yeah.
have a similar
point is that if you were to say to me, Maggie, what are your favorite films in terms of cinematography? I would be able to, like, sit down and think about it. I would not come up with any of these films, but I would not fault any of these films for their cinematography.
Okay.
That's my point. Like, he's good at what he does because he's sort of... I didn't think about it. If that makes sense. Like, I thought about the cinematography in this movie.
I think the director is definitely a big part of, like, whatever director he's working with has a very specific style as well,
mm-hmm.
which is why I think movies like The Sixth Sense and Signs do really have some great cinematography in them that I think is more memorable. I would love to go back and watch some of these other movies we're talking about on his filmography, because maybe there are, like I said, maybe there are some similarities that I'm just not aware of because I haven't seen some of these in a while. Rotten Tomatoes gives Silence of the Lambs a 95% from critics.
Yeah, I mean, this movie was a fucking banger when
and
it
audiences
came out.
Agree with a 95%. So I'm pretty sure that the world agrees that the Silence of the Lambs is just one of the best movies to come out of the 90s.
Yeah, I like, when you think about the 90s in terms of film, I think that this movie is always going to be on any top 10 list of, like, best 90s film.
Absolutely.
With the exception, like, if they were obviously, if they did a best 90s comedy, I don't think Silence
sure.
of the Lambs is.
No, if you're going to do it by genre, best 90s, and then...
Yeah.
But genre.
Otherwise, like, when you think of 90s film, this is definitely a film that you consider.
Yeah, if you're talking about horror, this could be a great 90s horror. I know this is on a lot of horror lists.
Although I don't necessarily see it as a horror film, but
I think it's one of those, like,
subjective.
It's
because it's spookier than your average. It's spookier than your average detective thriller had been to that point.
I think serial killer.
Yeah.
Is a subgenre in
both horror and, like, cop dramas.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
it's kind of like how Seven is also viewed as a horror film.
Well, in that case, this is my favorite horror film.
I mean, suspense is, like, rides that line with horror. And
so
Silence of the Lambs
thriller.
And Seven are very suspense thriller.
Yeah.
Detective noir, all that kind of.
Although, this movie is so much better than Seven.
Yeah.
And I think
we'll get into that.
We'll get into it.
It was made for $19 million, which even in 1989, 90, whenever they were actually working on this movie,
they
a
made
baby
this movie,
budget.
That's like a modern day indie film budget. I don't think Kevin Smith made Clerks for over $1 million. Holy shit. This movie cost $20 million to make.
In 2025 money.
Yeah.
That's about $45 million.
Yeah. I mean, they make good small movies for that.
They do. Well, sort of. I mean,
sometimes you're right. Like
Ari Aster's third film, Beau Is Afraid, was made for $30 million.
Yeah.
And that was considered expensive for the kind of movies that A24 usually deals with.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, Silence of the Lambs would have 1,000%.
Because Ari Aster, I believe Ari Aster's earlier stuff was made for 20 or less.
Yeah. I just can't fathom this movie costs only $20 million to make. That's awesome and insane.
Actually, Ari Aster's both his first two films were made for $9 and $10 million.
Well, goddamn. My whole point is that if Silence of the Lambs came out today, it would be an A24 project.
Oh, I'm sure.
And it would be terrifying.
Well, and that's kind of what, isn't that kind of what Orion sort of is?
I guess.
Kind of like the
I guess I never thought about sub-tier,
maybe not independent films, but definitely like a Blumhouse level studio.
Yeah. I guess I never really thought about that because I don't think Orion really exists much anymore, does it?
I don't think so. Yeah. That's a very 80s, 90s.
Yeah. Like, I remember watching that, like thing pop up.
Every now and then, you run into one of those Instagram posts. It's like, what's the first movie you think of when you see this? And
yeah.
Sometimes they show, like, Touchstone Pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, all those production companies that you just don't see on the screen anymore. And
yeah.
I feel like Orion is another one of those.
It's one. I mean, it's a big fucking movie.
It's a big movie. Yeah. And I saw it a lot when I was younger. It was mostly on TV, so it was heavily edited.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of parts I never saw until much later. Like Buffalo Bill dancing.
Yeah.
I didn't see that whole scene until I was, I think, in my early 20s.
I don't actually remember the first time I watched this movie. I definitely know it wasn't when I was a teenager going through a bit of a phase because I had seen it up, you know, before then.
I was a teenager, but... and however, my parents definitely were not home.
Yeah.
But it was definitely on TV. And edited.
Yeah. I love the fact that even on TV and edited, you still had to watch it when your parents
weren't. Oh, yeah. They still would not approve of an edited version of this film when I was... I mean, this movie came out when I was 10.
Yeah.
So I probably didn't see it until I was 14, 15.
Yeah. Knowing my parents and the way they watched rated R movies around us, I probably saw this movie at 10.
You probably did.
Definitely saw this movie at 10. They were like, come watch this with us. I don't know if they did it intentionally, but obviously they raised a cinephile. So even as a kid, I was like, oh, fuck yeah. Movies.
Movies. Movies are cool.
I mean, they watched Red Dawn and fucking, you know, all sorts of movies with us that we shouldn't have watched as a young age. And but what they wouldn't let me watch was Beavis and Butthead. It makes no sense to me. They'd let me watch Silence of the Lambs, but not Beavis and Butthead.
So we've established that in today's money, it was made for $45
million. Yes.
So it made, in 1990, it made $131 million domestically, $142 million internationally, for a total of $273 million, which in today's money would... bring it to $655 million.
Ooh,
so that was
that's a certified hit.
Massive hit. Massive hit. Not only was it a hit financially, but it also won. It swept the Oscars.
Yeah, it did.
And by swept the Oscars, I mean it took home the big five.
Mm-hmm.
And the big five are picture, actor, actress,
mm-hmm.
director, and writer. And if you win those five,
there's three movies who have ever done it, and Silence of the Lambs was the last.
Silence of the Lambs was the very last one to do it. I know the last one to do it before Silence of the Lambs was 1975's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
So from 75 to 91, nobody was getting that.
Yeah, and from 91 to present, nobody has gotten them.
So very rare to do. But Silence of the Lambs pulled it off. It won a total of 71 awards, including 5 Oscars, as we established. It won Best Film against Bugsy, JFK, and The Prince of Tides.
I remember vaguely Bugsy, and then what was the other one?
JFK.
JFK. I've never seen JFK.
JFK, like I said in a prior episode, I saw in middle school.
Yes.
Anthony Hopkins won the Best Actor mm-hmm. Award, Best Actor Oscar, beating Warren Beatty, who was Bugsy, yeah. Robert De Niro in Cape Fear.
Fucking people love Cape Fear.
I've never seen it. Yeah. Nick Nolte in The Prince of Tides. And Robin Williams was nominated that year for Fisher King.
Oh.
Which I have never seen.
I've never seen, but I've heard of.
Jodie Foster mm-hmm. won Best Actress, and she beat out Gina Davis, who was in Thelma and Louise.
Mm-hmm.
Laura Dern in Rambling Rose. Bette Midler for The Boys, and Susan Sarandon in Thelma and Louise.
What a solid fucking...
The fact that I didn't know Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis were both nominated for Thelma and Louise.
I've never seen Thelma and Louise.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I have seen that one. It's fun.
Man, maybe I'm not a cinephile. Maybe I just like movies. I don't know the difference.
The problem is that there are a lot of movies.
There's a lot of movies out there.
And not enough time.
No. There's no time.
We just need time to stop.
Yeah.
Like.
But then, well, maybe that's what the next version of this podcast is revisiting movies we've never seen.
Movies
before.
That we should have seen by now,
yeah,
but haven't.
Unfortunately, 2001 might be on that list, but I fucking refuse to watch that.
Well, we'll get there when we get there. Let's not jump the gun. It may not be on the list at all. Jonathan Demme won Best Director. He beat out John Singleton for The Boys in the Hood, Barry Levinson for Bugsy, Oliver Stone for JFK, and Ridley Scott for Thelma and Louise.
Ridley Scott did Thelma and Louise?
He did. You didn't know that?
No!
I know it's very much against the usual movies that he goes for.
Fuck, I know.
Especially in the early 90s.
For the fact that I talk a lot about how movies get spoiled for me.
Yeah.
Thelma and Louise hasn't been. I mean, it has. I know what happens at the end.
Sure.
So that's been spoiled for me.
It's
and
very
I know,
much Butch Cassidy and yeah. Sundance Kid.
Yeah, which I also haven't seen.
But you know how that ends,
yes,
too.
Yes, I do. I know about that scene, and I know about the scene where they are, like, in a hotel room after Brad Pitt robbed them. And that is not the whole movie.
Wait.
Brad Pitt.
Thelma and Louise?
Is in Thelma and Louise. But that's all I know about Thelma and Louise, is just how it ends. And the Brad Pitt of it all. The rest of the movie, I have no fucking clue what happens. So I would be willing to watch it.
All right. That would be a fun one to watch.
It would be a fun one. Maybe one of our bonus episodes.
Yeah, you never know.
But no, I didn't realize that that was a Ridley Scott film.
And then the last award on the Big Five is writing. Mm-hmm. And Ted Talley won for Best Adapted Screenplay.
Had they nominated anybody for leading actor in The Lord of the Rings and leading actress, do you think that The Return of the King could have swept the Big Five? Do you think that they would have been like, sure, Viggo Mortensen is Aragorn, here's your Oscar?
But he wasn't even nominated, was he?
No, he wasn't. I mean, I guess the argument also could have been made for Elijah Wood as best actor, but I think also it came down to, because it's such a huge ensemble piece, that there was no one leading actor. And if anything, it would have been Ian McKellen, and he got supporting.
I'd have to look it up, but I'd be interested to know if they got more as an ensemble cast at, like, the Golden Globes or something.
Yeah, I think they got the SAG for sure. Anyways, we'll look at that later. Good for everybody for winning their Oscars for Silence of the Lambs.
And the only two Oscars that it didn't win,
because
it was nominated for 7, it was nominated for Best Sound and Film Editing. And lost to Terminator 2 Judgment Day and JFK, respectively.
Yeah, no, that wasn't going to be... I've never seen JFK, but I know enough about it. That got editing, right?
Yeah,
got
editing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then fucking, of course, Terminator 2.
Terminator 2, Best Sound.
Fuck yeah. I mean, yeah.
Sure.
So, because I was about to be like, well, an argument can be... Nope. No arguments made.
Like, I appreciate that Silence of the Lambs got nominated for sound.
Yeah,
I
mean, because the sound's fairly decent.
I mean, it's good enough to get nominated for an Oscar. Yeah. I mean, it's been a while since I haven't listened to Silence of the Lambs with, like, surround sound set up or in headphones.
So all the little noises that you otherwise miss on a regular TV set.
Probably can't really hear, whereas I can see how a movie like Terminator 2 could definitely get sound. I mean, I just rewatched, it's been probably about a decade since I had seen it, but I rewatched Eraserhead out of homage to the late
David Lynch.
The sound design. I told somebody that when I watched Eraserhead for the first time, I think I had rented it through Netflix's mailing system and got the DVD in the mail and watched it on a tube TV with the speakers, you know, on the TV, and that's it.
Yeah.
Just heard the audio through those. But when I rewatched it this time, I had headphones on, and the movie is famous for its sound design.
Yeah.
And when you hear a movie that wins for best sound, and you go back and listen to it, like last year's Oscars went to The Zone of Interest, mm-hmm. which the entire movie is, the main part of the movie is its sound.
Yeah, because you hear things like screams and gunshots in the distance, but it's never really acknowledged.
You never see anything.
Yeah.
You hear the violence, you don't see the violence, which almost makes it worse.
Mm-hmm.
But fantastic sound, and that's another movie I haven't seen since the theater and would love to listen to it like in a very quiet, probably headphones on, and just dive into
something
like that.
You know, it's interesting. I like to, I'm a big music fan. I love to listen to music. And there are times when I'm feeling particularly stoned that I like to put on my headphones and listen to songs. Like I have a playlist and just really get into all the different sounds. But I've never thought about doing that with a movie that I've loved. If I were to say Lazy Afternoon, put my headphones on and listen to Pride and Prejudice, would it change things for me? Would I be able to hear it more? That might be a new fun thing to do instead of just like, you know, playing games on my phone and listening to music. I can like watch a movie and just really get into it with my headphones on. Thanks for that idea.
Yeah.
I've literally never thought about doing that. Because like when we went and saw the Fellowship of the Ring on the big screen, when it rolled back through last year, you and I both talked about how the sound design, being able to hear it on a studio speakers.
Well, because it had been...
It's been years.
2001 that I saw it in the theater.
So I forgot a lot of the sound.
Everything else that I've seen since were on my own home theater system,
mm-hmm.
which I really like my surround sound.
Yeah, you've got a pretty decent one.
But it's not theater quality.
No.
It's not set up to be like that.
No.
So when we went and saw it, we were hearing...
All sorts of things that we've forgotten.
I was like, oh my God.
Especially just the noises the ring makes.
Yeah. It makes, like, you know, it whispers.
Yeah.
You know, there's noise that it makes, but then there's other decibels of mm-hmm. noise that is also happening that you don't really hear on a home video system. Wow. Yeah. I love every aspect of filmmaking.
I know. It's pretty incredible what they do. Like, if you ever take a step back and, like, really look at it, you're like, Jesus Christ, the way that these people just tell stories.
I was watching a guy on Instagram. It was an old video.
Yeah.
But it was a video of a guy editing a film by cutting it and taping mm-hmm. it back together, putting it through a machine, finding the exact frame that he wanted to cut in.
Yeah.
Cut it.
Tape it.
Tape it.
Yeah.
Play it again. And then just go through that whole process and forming a film. And he's just treating the film like it's just mm-hmm. like a Christmas ribbon. Just watching him just go through this, just, you know, it looks like miles of film. And just seeing him, the process, talk about like getting your hands like into the...
And dedication.
Yeah, just into the project. He was also, I believe, the director of the film. And I wish I could remember... which director and which film mm-hmm. it was, but just watching the process was amazing.
All movies are is just a guy standing at the campfire telling stories to the other Neanderthals. That's all it is. We've been telling stories from the dawn of time, and we just keep finding better ways of telling the stories. It used to be some dude just standing at the campfire telling you a fucking story.
Yeah. Then we started writing it down,
plays...
Recording our voices.
Like, all of it. What technology has allowed us to do, just so that we can sit back and listen to a story as told by, you know, the camp shaman. It's amazing. And we're so lucky. Especially because we get to watch movies like Silence of the Lambs, which is such a great fucking film and holds up. And we also get to, like, deep dive into fucking Moon Knight and, you know... Fucking, like, what are some of my, like, America's Next Top Model? Like, dumb shit.
Silence of the Lambs stars Jodie Foster.
Yep.
Which, do you have a favorite Jodie Foster film? Mine's between this and Contact.
Fucking, I don't even have to look at her IMDb. It's Contact. Contact is my favorite Jodie Foster film. I was about to pull up her IMDb because in my head I was like, fucking, what have I seen with Jodie Foster in it? Yeah, of course, Contact. That movie's amazing. We have to watch Taxi Driver for this podcast. I've never seen it. I'm interested to see it because of how young she was when she made it.
She was very young in that one.
But I can't think of a movie. I remember I saw Anna and the King. Better. I don't know if I liked it.
I mean, I like Maverick. I like her character in Maverick specifically.
She's all right in Maverick. I think that she was miscast because I don't believe this clearly lesbian as being a... I mean, I think even as a kid, I was like, I'm pretty sure she's a lesbian. Like, I don't see her in that sort of like Southern Belle cowgirl-esque role.
I also am a... I'm not like a huge fan of Panic Room.
Yeah.
But I like Panic Room. Like
I've seen it, but it's been since it came out on video.
Like I've got the David Fincher categories of these are my favorites,
mm-hmm.
these are okay, and these are so-so. And Panic Room falls into these are okay.
Mm-hmm. Going through her IMDb is a proper deep dive. Yes, Contact is my favorite film that she was in. I mean, that movie
Contact's a solid is film.
Flawless.
I mean, we were just talking about it because it is a Robert Zemeckis film. Mm-hmm.
Although, again, I don't buy the chemistry between Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey because she is clearly a lesbian.
Sure.
And good for her. Like, get it, girl. But just, I never believed her chemistry with men, with the exception of this movie and Scott Glenn. Her and Scott Glenn have a chemistry that I cannot understand and I cannot deny and I would totally watch.
Her and Scott Glenn?
Yes. Because there's something between those two characters, and I'm like, oh.
I hope not, because it seemed more like a father-daughter relationship.
I legitimately Googled whether or not they ever had an affair, and they don't, because I couldn't remember if they ever did have a thing, but they didn't.
They didn't.
Those two characters, I mean, not Jodie Foster, and Scott Glenn themselves, but Clarice and Crawford.
Then we got Sir Anthony Hopkins.
Are you going to ask me his favorite movie, too? Because I'll have to pull up his IMDb.
I mean, yeah, I will. I think The Silence of the Lambs is his best film that he ever did. I think Hannibal Lecter is the best character he ever portrayed.
Yes. What if I just said
definitely
that
his most famous, his, but I think it's his best
what if I said that Rebel Moon was my favorite Anthony Hopkins movie?
I mean, his character in Rebel Moon is the best character in that.
It's the only character
entire.
I still would die for Jimmy, movie. But those movies are so fucking bad.
I haven't watched a lot of Anthony Hopkins, his work that like in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't. I think the 90s were. I don't know how famous he was in the 70s and 80s, or if did Silence of the Lambs bring people to know who he was,
it was
the mainstream.
It was his Hollywood breakthrough. Yeah, because up until that point, he had been upset that he hadn't broken into Hollywood yet, and this was kind of his last ditch effort of doing it. And I think he probably would have been happy to stay an actor in England, but I think that he did want to break into Hollywood.
We talked about this last week, but Meet Joe Black. It was first. It was on the Brad Pitt side of Meet Joe Black. Now it's the Anthony Hopkins side of Meet Joe Black because his character is like essentially the multi-millionaire, maybe not billionaire yet,
mm-hmm.
But he's the guy that death is visiting and preparing.
Yes.
Titus is a movie that
fucking
I really like.
Titus. So my history with Titus is the day that I got the rejection letter from the one college I really wanted to go to the most. I didn't tell anyone about it. I took it into my bedroom. I cried myself to sleep. I slept, and I mean, I cried myself to sleep at like 4 p.m. I woke up at like maybe like 1 or 2 a.m., right? Fully awake because I just had a full night's sleep just at the wrong time. And my friend had lent me Titus. And so I went into the living room and was like, this is a good time to watch this movie, not knowing.
Jeez.
And then I watched Titus and then I turned it off and I went back to bed and I decided never to watch Titus ever again.
Did you finish it?
I finished it.
Okay.
Oh, no. I watched it in completion and I sat there and I was like, because that's a wild, you know, 15 hours for a human being to be rejected from the one college they wanted to go to the most. And then crying themselves to sleep out of sadness and failure, and then watching Titus. at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Like, that's a weird time to be alive.
Just in case people don't know Titus, it is the story of Titus Andronicus
It's the Shakespearean
play.
Titus.
Titus. Yeah. The Julie Taymor
movie with Anthony Hopkins. It's fucking wild.
I love it.
I know you do.
I love it so much.
You Anthony love it
Hopkins,
so much.
Jessica Lange.
Yeah.
That's how I don't think I knew who Jessica Lange was before that movie.
Forever, babe.
By
the way, really quickly, favorite Anthony Hopkins film? Legends of the Fall.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was literally the same thing just we were talking about
that with Brad Pitt as well.
Fucking Legends of the Fall is one of my favorite films of all time. Favorite Anthony Quinn movie? Actually, no, take that back. Practical Magic. That's my favorite Anthony Quinn movie. But Legends of the Fall is a solid number two there.
He also makes a really cool Odin.
He does. I like him in the Thor movies because, first of all, I know that Kenneth Branagh tried to make a Shakespearean tragedy with Thor 1, which is why Anthony Hopkins is in it, because they've done shit together forever. Like, it makes all the sense in the world that, you know, Kenneth Branagh and Anthony Hopkins made a Shakespearean Marvel film, which is the first Thor. People love it or they hate it. I personally love it. I think it's great. But he's so much more fun in Ragnarok. So of the three of those movies, for me, it's Ragnarok. Because he's playing he's playing Tom Hiddleston playing Odin. And he's just having the time of his life. And then on top of the scenes, you know, what little scenes he has in that film. But what if the Marvel cartoon series has taught us anything, it's that every single one of Odin's children would have been better off without Odin as their father.
That really is what those stories have told us.
All three of them live
better lives
in the worlds where they are not raised by him. Yeah.
Scott Glenn.
Fucking Scott Glenn. Motherfucking Scott Glenn. I love him so much.
Scott Glenn's great. I love anytime. I haven't watched a ton of Scott Glenn movies. One of my favorite Scott Glenn.
He pops up in everything.
One of my favorite Scott Glenn films is The Hunt for Red October.
Yeah.
His character in that as a submarine captain is he's one of my favorite submarine captains of all the submarine movies. No, because there are famous submarine movies,
mm-hmm.
and in those submarine movies there are captains.
Yep.
And they all have very different personalities, but Scott Glenn's character is my favorite. He's got humor, but he also commands respect,
mm-hmm.
and he's smart. I love Scott Glenn in Hunt for Red October.
For me, like I very vividly remember watching The Right Stuff. First of all, my family has watched Backdraft for years. That Backdraft was like a favorite movie in my household. It is a movie that I don't like only because it scares me, because fire scares me. It's a movie I've seen a ton, and I know that he's in it, but Backdraft always made me so terrified of fire that I didn't like watching it. But The Right Stuff, where he plays Alan Shepard, that movie is so goddamn good.
Oh, yeah. His Alan Shepard is fantastic.
The Right Stuff is such a good fucking movie. It's a great film. And I haven't seen it in years, but the first time I ever watched it, I was in California in my living room. It was like 10 or 11 o'clock at night. I was, you know, an adult teenager, somewhere in that range. And this movie came on about space, and I am a secret space nerd. And so I was like, oh, okay, well, you know, I'll play on my fucking computer on my Tumblr account or whatever and just have this on in the background. And I could not take my eyes off of it. I watched the entire movie. It's a 3-hour movie. It started at 11 p.m. And I stayed up and watched the whole thing because I was just like mind blown by how fucking good that movie is. And that movie came out in 83.
Mm.
And it's still such a good fucking movie.
One of my favorite Scott Glenn films, and this might be my favorite other than his submarine captain character, but him in Silverado.
You know, I haven't seen Silverado since I was a kid.
Oh my god. Silverado from 1985. It's a Lawrence Kasdan film.
My mom fucking loved Silverado.
Silverado is one of my favorite westerns. It's Kevin Kline, Scott Glenn, Kevin Costner, Rosanna Arquette, John Cleese, Brian Dennehy.
How have I not fucking seen this?
Danny Glover, Jeff Goldblum.
We need to watch Silverado.
Silverado, is, like I said, it is legitimately one of my favorite westerns. And like I said,
for me, I always associated it with my mom putting it on and me as a kid being bored with westerns because I didn't learn to appreciate westerns until I was older. And always just being like, ugh, and then going off and doing something else, even though I wanted to be on the TV. It's like if we kicked Jack off the TV right now and so that we could watch Silverado, he'd have the same reaction of just like, damn it. I guess I'd love to see it to understand why my mom loved it so much, and I'd also love to see it because that fucking cast is amazing.
I mean, think about this, Maggie. Lawrence Kasdan wrote the screenplays for Empire Strikes Back and Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Mm-hmm.
Take those two movies,
yep.
Put them together into a Western.
With Scott Glenn.
With Scott Glenn and all those other actors that I just listed.
Yeah.
It's a good time. We're watching it.
We're watching it. Scott Glenn is particularly great in the Daredevil series. He plays Stick.
Stick, yeah. He's great in that.
And he's great in anything that he pops up in. And I'm never unhappy to see Scott Glenn because my boner for Scott Glenn is eternal. Sort of the same way that it is for Donald Sutherland. It's just I see them and whatever age, I'm like, yes, please. I adore him. He's just that thin, gravelly voiced, usually kind of an asshole. And it does it for me. You know he smells like cigarettes. But Scott Glenn in this movie particularly, because he wears a three-piece suit with a vest, and his skinny frame in that three-piece vested suit, unbelievably hot. Just unbelievably hot, which is maybe why I'm trying to read into him and Clarice being a thing. Anyways, Ted Levine is also in this movie.
Ted Levine is also in this movie.
Favorite film of his is Evolution.
Oh, yeah, the general.
Fucking, I love Evolution so much.
Oh, God.
Ted Levine, good for him. When I think of him, I think immediately of this movie. Immediately.
Well, sure.
As soon as I see him, I'm immediately taken back to...
It's a breakout role, for sure. He's got a very specific voice.
Mm-hmm.
You can't beat that voice. I mean, he's in Heat. He's in Wild Wild West as General Bloodbath McGrath.
He's in Shutter Island, too.
Oh, so we'll be seeing him later. He played one of the cops in the very first Fast and Furious movies. He's Paul Walker's boss, essentially.
Uh-huh.
And he's great. Like, as soon as you see and hear him, you're just like, Buffalo Bill.
He's also Sinestro in the Justice League Unlimited cartoon series, which... pretty sure is a Green Lantern villain.
He is.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember him in JLA.
I don't remember him in it, but at the fact that he played a character in Justice League Unlimited.
And he also played a Nazi lieutenant in Justice League as well.
Yeah, of course he did. Ted Levine has been in a ton of things. He's a great character actor, but he is very recognizable because of that voice. I will talk forever about Evolution with David Duchovny. As one of my favorite dumb comedies to watch, right? Like David Duchovny and Julianne Moore have such great chemistry, and which is not surprising because she should have also been Scully. Like that movie is so fucking stupid and it's so fucking funny. And he plays the Colonel Woodman. He's a dick, but of course he is. I don't think I've ever seen him as a lighthearted, kind, loving character. I've never seen him as the romantic interest.
You might be able to tell me more, but the only other actor that I'm even familiar with is Frankie Faison, who played
Barney.
I know Frankie Faison because he's in Coming to America. He's in the Thomas Crown Affair.
I love the Thomas Crown Affair so much.
He's a character actor that's just been in things.
Yeah, he's all around
forever.
I think I knew of him because of my weird, slight Silence of the Lambs obsessive phase. Because I'm pretty sure he's in Manhunter. I might be wrong. But he's definitely in...
What year did Manhunter come out?
80s. I want to say he plays a detective.
Oh, he was in Mississippi Burning. Oh, yeah, he was in Manhunter.
See, he was in Manhunter.
Lieutenant Fisk in Manhunter, and then Barney in...
He was in Barney and Silence Slams, and then he comes back in Hannibal.
Is he in any... Oh, he comes back... Oh, yeah, playing the same character,
yeah, Barney, and then still. I think he even plays Barney in Red Dragon. So, like...
Wow.
I think I knew of him because of his connection with the overall trilogy. But he's just, you know, one of those great character actors... Like, this is a good cast, but it's a good cast of believable actors. But the top four being Jodie Foster, Anthony Hopkins, Scott Glenn, and Ted Levine kill it in all of their roles. You know, Hannibal Lecter has been listed in the top five easily of, like, best villains of all time in a lot of different lists. And I think that that's really interesting because those lists have been made since this movie came out. But at the time, we only really knew Hannibal Lecter from this movie. An argument can be made for Manhunter because it came out before, but it was a flop. So, you know, Silence of the Lambs is what made Hannibal Lecter like a mainstream character. And based on this performance alone, he is constantly rated as one of the best villains of all time. Do you agree? And why is that true? He's just so fucking good.
Silence of the Lambs is such a fantastic film.
Yeah.
I think it's probably the best film of 1991. Well, hot take.
Hot take, yeah.
Oh, wait. No, it won awards for that.
No,
but what I mean is...
I think it should be higher on this list.
Yes, it should be higher on this list. It should be higher, and I absolutely agree. And we don't need to argue about it because I absolutely agree that this movie should have come before Seven.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I would say that the shock value of Seven is what probably gets it put above this, because this movie is
very tame,
but it's tame.
It's tame until pretty much the end.
Yeah. But it's tame. It's just because it's tame doesn't mean it's not terrifying.
It hides a lot of its gore.
Yeah, it's a lot of innuendo. It's a lot of references to.
But that's why it's better.
That's why it's good. Yeah.
That's why it's good, because it's not overly.
It's not in your face.
It's not in your face. It's not doing anything overboard. It's.
If this movie were made today, it would be more in your face, violent and gory.
Or if it was made today, like you said, it would be made by A24. Yeah. It would be distributed by A24,
yeah.
And
it'd win some awards.
It would, yeah, and it would be the same exact movie because it's kind of like,
yeah, you can't.
It's really stuck in time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not timeless because you can tell that it's from
set in like a late '80s, early '90s kind of
feel to it.
Dated and how it looks.
Yeah, how it looks, the technology, clothing, all that normal stuff.
Adds to it too, right? Because if Clarice had a cell phone. Things wouldn't have gone the way that they did, right?
Probably
if Hannibal had the internet, things wouldn't have gone the way that they've done. It would have been a different movie for this era because of our technology.
Right.
So it is one of those great films because so often Clarice is put into a situation, especially at the end in Buffalo Bill's house, you know, where she's alone and there's nobody to help her. Or she's in a room full of strange men who are glaring at her and she doesn't have the modern sensibility of being like, go fuck yourself. You know, I love that this movie was made when it was, because that is what makes it so good. If the story was made today, it would be gorier. It would be, you know, more violent.
Yeah.
You know, the violence of this film really, for the most part, is in that scene where Hannibal attacks his guards. And that's kind of.
And that's the only thing you see.
Yeah.
Because when Bill kidnaps the lieutenant.
Governor, the senator.
Senator's.
Yeah, whoever she was.
daughter. You don't see it.
No.
Happen. Like, yes, like you see her get into the van.
But happen,
she willingly gets into the van.
Yeah, and you don't see what happens
inside
of the van. You don't
see anything that happens.
It's just the outside point of view.
And then she's always inside of the pit.
Yeah.
Nothing's really. You don't see anything really bad happening to anybody in the film.
Except for those prison guards.
Yeah, and, you know, there are dead bodies
that
they are investigating that Bill has left in
but
rivers.
But even those scenes are shot with a deftness because they don't want to show a bloated river.
Right, they
you know,
barely
corpse.
Show it. And the very, very end, they show it. It's a wide shot.
From far behind. And that's such a shocking scene because that's one of the few things you see in that movie.
I remember going into this movie when I first watched it expecting there to be a lot of violence and a lot of gore.
But it's used perfectly.
And I think, it's very similar to the way Jaws was made.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it was made that way because their animatronic was not working.
Yeah.
But
it
ended up working in their favor in the long run because
it made the scarier film.
It made a scarier movie because you don't see the shark, you know, and Alien, you don't see the alien. And
It's kind of a lost art, too. I feel like we give stuff away too much in our movies these days, right?
You don't see the in Silence of the Lambs, you don't see the violence.
You don't see the violence against women, especially.
Right, which is the villain of the... Or, I mean, just people killing other people in general. This movie is about a couple of serial killers. One has already been caught. When I first watched this movie, I thought the movie was about Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, but it's not. So do you everybody think had that always... Ted Levine is like, son of a bitch, I got upstage.
Right.
Because he does a phenomenal job unto his own. He does,
absolutely. But the movie's not...
Everybody remembers.
The movie's about him, but it's not about him.
Yeah, but he's the movie's main
about
villain.
Clarice and Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
And
I think it's mostly about Clarice. It's just that Hannibal and Buffalo Bill and Chilton and... Crawford are all just
but I think
parts of it, but the story
I think Lecter has the bigger role in her life in
yes
this movie.
That is true, but she's still definitely the main character.
She's
also voted in some of like the top like biggest heroes of all time or best heroes of all time, and she's usually like the highest ranking woman on the list because it's always like Batman, Superman, fucking Captain America, fucking, I don't know, Donald Duck, fucking, and then they're like Clarice Starling.
Yeah, usually the women on those lists come down to Sarah Connor, Ripley, and Clarice.
Yeah.
Those are probably those three women are the heroes of the 70s through 90s.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to think that the list obviously has expanded since then, but I still can't put, like, Wonder Woman or Captain Marvel above those three women.
Obviously.
You know, I just can't. Like, Wonder Woman as a character,
list
maybe.
The list has expanded since then.
But I think that there's some inclination that there's a bit of a romantic tension between Hannibal and Clarice, although I don't agree with that. I think it's more of, like, a Hannibal looking at her. But I don't think that he ever really looks at her lustfully. I think he looks at her as puzzled and as a respected foil to his own madness. So that's why I don't agree with the fact that in Hannibal, the book, they become a romantic pairing and run off together. I prefer... No, and I haven't seen Hannibal, the movie, in a very long time, so I don't 100% remember how it plays out. But I know that it's very much kept as platonic... kind of a mentor-mentee thing almost, and definitely like a cat and mouse thing. But I do love when he hands her the file and their fingers touch for a moment. Mainly love that because I would like to think that, for Hannibal especially, the reason he touches her finger is that the only other touch he's ever had is by prison guards and the warden who are mean to him.
Right.
Not that Barney's mean to him. In fact, Barney is very respectful to him.
But it's different because it's his job and it's a prison system.
Whereas
she is an outside source.
And I think he actively wanted to feel her skin.
And he respects her.
Because he
For the most part.
Yes. Well, he toys with her, but I think he toys with her because he respects her. But I love that moment.
I think at the end, he promises to leave her alone because he respects her.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of the Joker and Batman of it all, right? Like, she's too interesting to kill. Joker has too much fun with Batman to downright kill him.
Right.
Because he respects Batman for being his own personal antagonist. And I think that's the same for Hannibal and Clarice. It's that they respect each other too much as their own personal antagonist to ever do anything about it. Life would be more boring for Hannibal if Clarice wasn't in it. And that's why he would never actually hurt her. Which, I guess in its own right, is a type of love. But I enjoy those stories.
That's more of a fatherly love, you could say.
Yeah, kind of.
Doesn't have to be romantic.
No, and see, that's the thing. It's like, you don't look at these two characters and think romantic.
No.
So the fact that the author did made a lot of people go, who the fuck?
It's almost as if he thought his fans would, like...
Yeah, like, they... it's not like a Mulder and Scully situation where everybody wanted them to get together. Everybody was like, no, thank you. The age difference, the what he is, the how he treat, like, no.
That's creator sure did want
not romantic. To. It's like pairing Nosferatu with a 21-year-old girl. It's just fucking creepy, man. Obviously, this movie has, you know, it spawned sequels. Hannibal being one that I think is a great film. Gary Oldman's in it. Julianne Moore takes over. You know, it's kind of shitty. The reason that Jodie Foster did not do Hannibal is because they followed the book script more, and she was like, I don't find these two as romantic partners. I will not do this script if you keep it that way. And so the producers went, thank you for letting us know that. We're still going to make this movie. And they went off and hired Julianne Moore, and then they changed the script to reflect a non-romantic pairing of these two characters. And Jodie Foster was like, that's the film I would have fucking done. I would have done this film, but you did not offer me this film. And I don't think that there's any animosity
I know, but what an a fucking odd,
thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, no, we're going to do it. We're going to do it. We're not going to do it. You said, no, we're not going to do it now. I found that kind of shitty. There is a movie called Hannibal Rising that is about his origins. It's an origin film back when those were a big thing. It came out in 20... I don't remember when. It was pre-kids. It was post-marriage and pre-kids, so it was somewhere in that vague area of our lives. We went to see this movie at our local movie theater.
Wait, you and me?
Yes.
Hannibal Rising.
Yes. But
I vaguely remember this.
But before, and here, there's a reason. Before we went to see that movie, which is attached to the mall, in the same parking lot was a Red Lobster, where a friend of yours worked as a bartender. Who got us hammered on free alcohol.
That's right. Now it's all coming together.
Hammered. That oh dude my God. Got us fucked up because he worked as a bartender at the Red Lobster and they did not weigh or check their alcohol. And that dude not only drank for free his entire shift, but he made like his friends could come in and drink for free.
I remember all of this. And now I remember I fucking hated that movie.
I don't remember that movie because I was so drunk while watching it that it felt like a fever dream. Like, I remember bits and pieces at best.
Didn't he eat his sister?
No, his sister was eaten in front of him.
Oh, fuck.
And then he decided, and this is all just out of, like, the fact that I remember any of this is insane. I think it's because I researched it afterwards, because I was like, I didn't see that.
So this
movie.
Is all coming back movie? To me now.
It's like, some, like, fucking Russians ate his sister, and so he went on a murderous vengeance-filled rampage to kill all of them, then he ate them for eating his sister. And that's how he became a cannibal, supposedly. Anyways, the only parts of that day that I remember is being at the Red Lobster, flashes of the movie where I was thinking to myself, God, I want tacos, and then us being at Jack and Box in the drive-thru getting said tacos. So my memory of this film is being hammered and Jack in the Box tacos, and I will never watch it again because I want to leave it at that.
Now I kind of want to. Now I kind of want to read all four of these books, though. Like, I bet the book is at least.
Yeah, you say that, but the book was not better for Hannibal. The movie was better.
I know, but you never know the evolution of a writer.
Well, yeah, but Hannibal and Hannibal Rising came out after The Silence of the Lambs. Hannibal Rising was the last book to come out. So, if you read them,
well, I know, but I mean, in time, like when he published those books, like you don't. Like, after writing Hannibal, maybe he looked at it different, wrote Hannibal Rising. Like, maybe it's a really good book.
Babe, if you want to read it, go ahead. But I'll never watch that movie again that movie experience is one of my most favorite.
I'm thinking more like all four books on Audible.
If you buy them, then I'll get to listen to them too. And I would happily listen to them again. Yeah, so that's my memory of Hannibal Rising. And sometimes still I forget that it was ever a movie. And Anthony Hopkins was in it.
Oh, man.
Like they paid him a lot of money for a small, like, I don't know, probably like a tag at the end of it or something. But I remember getting hammered.
I remember getting hammered.
The Box Tacos.
Yeah, because the
Yeah.
The Red Lobster was walking distance to the theater, and we were just like, yeah, let's just get hammered before we watch this movie.
Yeah. We'll go have a drink or two, and then it yeah. turned into and a he lot gave of us Scooby
so
snacks.
Much alcohol.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of Cheddar Bay biscuits. Because that's all we probably ate was Cheddar Bay biscuits.
Yeah. Isn't it funny? We never ordered food.
No. Calm no. down.
Aren't too expensive.
You glad that I remember these sort of wacky
Yeah, because then I'm going to be like, oh my God.
That was a very long time ago. As a woman, I find this movie very important because it shows not only a very strong woman getting through what she has to get through in order to, you know, succeed, but she's brave, she's true to herself, and she puts up with so much shit from dudes, and she holds such composure during it. There are so many scenes in this film where she is surrounded by men who are looking her up and down, who are judging her, who are sexualizing her, who are hating her because she dares be a woman in the FBI in the 90s. They use this film as a recruiting tool to get more women to join the FBI because there's so few female FBI agents when this film was made.
I have a friend
who
has a master's in not just criminology, but like it's like another
mm-hmm.
part of that.
A subset of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Very smart woman, and she just needs experience
mm-hmm.
to be able to get. Her lifelong dream is to get into the FBI.
Yeah.
And she is so close.
Yeah.
Because she's like got all the
credentials,
boxes
yeah, all
checked and all the credentials.
Yeah.
And the one thing that she doesn't have is like similar experience.
Mm-hmm.
So currently she is in the Army.
Yeah.
And
she's getting that experience.
Get that experience. And
good for her.
Yeah. It's.
I had a friend, too, that for a long time had the goal of being an FBI agent because of Agent Dana Scully. She never fully went down that path. She started, and then she got a husband and babies, and that was the end of that. Again, that was a woman who saw a strong female FBI agent and went, I want to do that. I do enjoy this film for the unwavering show of real-life womanhood. Which is all those moments. Because even still, like, men treat female, you know, enforcement officers that way. I mean, women still have a hard time in the Army, despite it all. Like, I love how this movie shows it. And I love that she does so much. You can see how strong she is holding on to that sensation of don't let it in. Don't let them see. Don't show it, you know. And so the moment when she's in the parking lot crying at her car after Migs fucking jizzed all over her and her first thing with, you know, her first visit with Hannibal, you know, she has a moment where she's just standing next to her car crying because you got to let it out, but right. You can't show it. And I love that. I think that Jodie Foster does a phenomenal job portraying that vulnerability and that strength at the same time. Because there's not a room in this film that she walks into that she doesn't command in her own way, but that is even literally at the detriment of, like, all the men glaring at her. And I love those point of view shots. I also love the way that most of the conversation shots are shot very close up and very, like, in, like, straight down the camera. I don't know if you noticed, but most of the times that Clarice is having a conversation with another character, they are staring directly in the camera as if you're seeing from her point of view.
Right.
But then when it does her coverage, she's not looking. She's still like facing the camera head on, but she's not looking at the camera because it's not her point of view.
Right.
And I love those uncomfortable up close like scenes of just her and Hannibal. And that's all that the screen is, just her face or Hannibal's face in the conversation, because it makes you feel like you're in it.
It also, I mean, not that it happened with this film. I mean, it might help with production costs, but it's a little trick that a lot of filmmakers will do where they, during conversations, they'll zoom much closer to a person's face and mm-hmm. head. That way, they don't have to be as detailed with production design. And
the production design's pretty good in this film.
Oh, no, it is. Like, I mean, there's not a lot to it.
No.
There's a lot of offices.
The choice of putting Hannibal behind glass.
Glass, sure.
Was a specific one made by the director because he didn't like not being able to see the Anthony Hopkins' performance.
Yeah, I mean, could you imagine bars?
I could not.
Blocking him?
No, absolutely not. And it also makes it scarier that she walks past all those jail cells that are bars, and then like glass, because you know that motherfucker.
You see the glass before you see Hannibal.
Yeah.
And I love, the reveal. His first reveal is so good, especially because as soon as you see him, he's staring right at you.
Yeah, and he doesn't blink.
He doesn't blink.
And there's the way, physicality, how Anthony Hopkins holds himself with that big chest and his slender frame. And, you know, the way that he's standing so stern.
Like, at attention.
Proud. Yes, at attention. But that's his character.
Oh, yeah.
He's always, you know.
He's at attention.
He's a very refined man. And
he's paying attention.
Yeah. And, oh, that first reveal is so good.
The way he stares and the way he asks for her credentials,
mm-hmm.
and she's pulling it out and she's showing him. And at first you think he's looking at the credentials, but then you realize that he's still staring right at her.
Mm-hmm.
And even though she's already, like, gotten her credentials out and is showing them to him, he's not breaking eye contact
mm-hmm.
with her eyes.
And again, because our point of view is her point of view, he's staring right down the dead soul of you.
Yeah, and so, and then you finally see the eyes go down to look mm-hmm. at the credentials.
And so fast, down and back up, and he's immediately just like, that only lasts a week.
Yeah.
I already
know the expiration date and where you grew up and who your father was.
Never seen this movie on the big screen.
Neither have I.
It would be fun if there's ever a showing around us. It would be fun to go see, because I would love to experience those scenes on the big screen, especially at the end when you see her through the night vision and she's so terrified and she's just like, you know, but it's filmed as if you were looking through the night vision at her. I think that would be incredible on a big screen. And the sound design, fuck, that'd be good. You know what my favorite version of Goodbye Horses is?
What's that?
The one in Clerks.
Oh.
Where Jay does the dance.
Yeah. Jason Mewes.
Yeah. That's why I think of that song. Does the whole Kill Bill
dance.
And I know that, like, it's from Kill Bill.
Down to
even
being nude in the scene.
Yeah. The Buffalo Bill. You said Kill Bill.
Oh.
But, yes. Whatever. Jason Mewes doing that exact same thing. It's like, it's sort of like how All Along the Watchtower, and this is like the third time I've brought this up, but All Along the Watchtower is the better version of the, you know, it's the better version of the song. The cover is better than the original. Jason Mewes doing that dance, for me, is better than Ted Levine doing that dance. I see that dance and I'm like, this should be Jason Mewes. It's what I think of. That scene was not in the original script. And it was something that Ted Levine himself fought for because he felt that it was important to the character. And I agree. How this movie handles trans people as well is actually almost with a more deft hand than you would think for a film from the early 90s. Because when they talk about transsexuals in this film, they never refer to it as being bad or weird. They just refer to Buffalo Bill himself as not being one. I'm shocked that for a film made in 1991, being trans was held with such reverence, or just it's not judged. It was never judged by any of the professionals. It's not judged by Hannibal either. They're all just like, we know what a transsexual is. This dude is not it. Which, you know, is not really their place to say if he felt that he was trans, but that's a modern day sensibility of it. But I think that it's interesting that it was never like, oh, he's a pervert because he's a transsexual. It wasn't that. They were like, no, he's just a pervert, but he is not a transsexual. And I appreciated that. It's shocking for a film in the 90s to kind of handle that topic with any sort of reverence and respect, as opposed to just making the joke out of it like they did in Ace Ventura.
Well, yes, that's making... See, that's the difference between...
Well, I mean, the two movies are
to
very
me, well, yes, there's a comedy and a crime thriller.
Another movie that handles a transgender character in a really gentle and respectful and loving way is shockingly The Wedding Singer. Because there's the person in his band that... Boy George, basically.
Yeah, they never bring attention to him.
Yeah, but like clearly here's a... And it was played by... And I do not remember the person's name, but it was played by a trans/gender queer person, an Arquette, but I don't remember the name of it. I don't remember which Arquette. It was played by a person who themselves was gender fluid, and so the character was also gender fluid. And it was, you know, the movie takes place in the 80s, and it's an Adam Sandler comedy that is ripe for making fun of trans people, but they don't. They just treat that character with love and respect, and it's really quite beautiful. And I remember watching The Wedding Singer like a couple years back and going, oh shit, they handled that so much better than I thought they would. Adam Sandler's done a couple things that are good, I guess. This movie taught me not to help people in vans.
Yeah,
it's true.
Yeah, don't help somebody with their couch.
Especially not in the middle of the night with a van. I'd just be like, yeah. I'll call somebody.
Yeah, let me get somebody who can help you.
I'm going to task rabbit over here for you.
I actually have a really damaged arm.
Yeah, I can't. Thank you. Thank you.
I have COVID or I don't know.
I'm going to go inside and call the cops now.
Bye.
Yeah.
The majority of the time that I've watched this film, I think it wasn't until this viewing that I really understood what Silence of the Lambs meant. Because it is an odd phrase.
It is an odd title.
Especially compared to everything that's going on. Especially... Because the thing that when I, going back to when I saw this movie for the first time,
you know,
when you see the poster, it doesn't look like anything, you know, you hear Silence of the Lambs and it's a woman's face with a moth over it.
Mm-hmm. And then once you look closer, the skull in the middle of the moth is not a skull, but it's five naked women forming the skull.
I can't look that close into it.
You've never seen that?
No.
Oh, damn.
But now I'm looking closer into it. Damn, that is so tiny.
Well, I mean, yeah, especially nowadays, but like imagine a poster, a full-size movie poster, and getting up close.
Sure. You know, so what does lambs have to do with a moth? And the whole movie, nobody ever says Silence of the Lambs. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially a dream she has, right?
No, that actually happened.
That actually happened with her father, right?
Yes. Well, no. Well, after her father died, she was sent to the lamb farm.
Oh, the lamb farm.
And then that's where she discovered them killing the lambs. The lambs screaming.
The lambs are screaming. And so, essentially, Hannibal is having a conversation with her about her wanting to silence the lambs because they're screaming.
Mm-hmm.
But he never says silence the lambs. He says screaming of the lambs, which is... the complete opposite of, so that was where I had my confusion, was because he was saying screaming of the lambs.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm currently showing Caveman a picture of the poster of Silence of the Lambs, and then it zooms in on the skull, which is five naked women, which then shows the artwork that they got, which is a Salvador Dali piece.
Was that drawn, or he actually had
had women like pose to that, yeah. So that's what the skull is in the middle of the poster. And I always knew that because I was the type of kid that got really close to movie posters and looked at them in fine detail.
A Salvador Dali piece?
Yes.
So because of these screaming lambs, Hannibal Lecter repeatedly says screaming of the lambs. Mm-hmm. And so I still was like, because there's never a moment where anything is talked about them being silenced. But essentially, it's her...
The lamb screaming is what propels her forward, right? It's that core memory that gets her to the point where she's like, I want to do all of this to become an FBI agent.
Right. Well, and it also has to do with, I need to be able to find this girl before she's killed.
Yeah.
And so she wants to silence... that possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not until I saw how the novel ends, which essentially ends with Clarice sleeping peacefully in the silence of the lambs.
Yeah.
Finally being able to rest.
Yeah. After, she doesn't hear him.
It's like a Tony Stark moment. Yes. Like, I finally saved the world. Now I can sleep.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's, you know, it was her inner demons that were propelling her forward, and she finally got to shut them up. I wouldn't know. I haven't been able to shut mine up yet, but we're working on it. Working on that Silence of Those Lambs. It's an interesting title for sure.
This movie, I know it didn't win editing, but man, the editing at the end where...
I was just about to bring up how fucking good.
Where you think... You see the cops press the doorbell.
Fucking, you see the cops at the door. You see the SWAT team at the door.
And then that cuts right to the bell ringing in Bill's basement. And then you see them do it again.
Yeah, like the whole buildup to him opening that fucking door.
He's working his way up to the first floor. He opens the door and it's Clarice. And you're just like, holy shit.
It's so fucking
It's
good.
So well done.
I would almost love to go back and rewatch this movie for the first time.
I'd love to know exactly what JFK did better than this.
You know, this was a movie I saw as a child. It's a movie you saw as a child. You know, we were both, I was probably a preteen. You were definitely a post-teen or just a teen. Imagine watching this movie for the first time, knowing nothing about it today. Like, you'd just be like, oh, it would be such a moment in the theater to watch everybody react to that cutback.
I'm sure that's what happened.
It was like, so good. I wish I could have been there.
I wish I could have seen this in the theater when it came out. Yeah.
That's kind of a very unique sorrow and grief for a movie fan to be like, I wish I could have been there when this movie first came out because I wish I could have appreciated the sort of
experience the moment.
It. Yeah. Like, we got to experience that with Endgame, of course, when Cap grabs, you know, when Cap lifts Mjolnir for the first time, our theater exploded. We've seen all the videos of the theaters exploding. Like, those moments are so genuine and so pure that they are so spontaneous.
And it's not just superhero stuff.
No,
it's like, it's... you know, when you find out that, spoilers, that Bruce Willis was dead the whole time. You know, you hear, you know, people gasping in the theater, people figuring the puzzle out. Mm-hmm. People, when people start putting the everything together and you all react together, it's a really...
You know what it also is?
Great moment.
It's when Hans says to Anna in Frozen, you know, if only I loved you. That was a moment where everybody in the theater was like, the fuck?
The fuck you say,
You know, because here's the love interest actually turning into the bad guy.
Yeah, he's supposed
to
be Prince Charming who's come to...
Yeah.
Yeah, because you've watched so many Disney films leading up to this, and now they've got
those
turned
moments
on its head.
Are why I love the movies so much. It's why I love seeing movies with people. It's why I love being in a crowd of nerds, of like-minded nerds, to watch it, because it's such a good moment. And I wish I could be in a theater not knowing that when he opens that door, Clarice was on the other side. Because then what follows is just such pure anxiety.
Oh, yeah.
And is so well filmed. When the lights go off on her and she's just fumbling around.
Yeah.
I actually forgot that she kills Buffalo Bill. I always, in my head when we were watching it the other day, I thought, somebody breaks in and saves her, right? But no,
she takes
saves
care
herself.
Of business.
Yeah. And I love her for it.
And it wasn't because she saw anything or felt anything, but she heard
the
hammer
going
back on his gun and just shot towards the noise.
Yeah.
she's
an FBI agent. She's better shot.
Trained. Yeah, she's... Yeah, no, it's a great movie.
It's a great fucking movie.
What would you give The Silence of the Lambs?
This is a five-star. It's a five-star.
It's absolutely a five-star film.
It's just too fucking good. And I don't know if, like, a month ago I would have said that. A month ago, if you would have just asked me right out, if you're like, Maggie, what do you rate Silence of the Lambs? And I had not seen it again. I'd probably be like, probably like a four. You know, I remember it being really good, but rewatching it, you know, with this new eye that I have for movies because of this silly little podcast and 50 episodes, it's a five fucking star movie. It's flawlessly good. And you agree, correct?
I absolutely agree. Five star film.
So fucking good.
So, Maggie.
Yes, Caveman.
I have two questions for you.
Hit it.
My heritage is something I'm very proud of, so every chance I get, I do. So I'm Oscar Isaac Hernandez Estrada.
You killed my father.
Idiot.
my heritage is something I'm very proud of. So every chance I get, I do. Say, I'm Oscar Isaac Hernandez Estrada. You killed my father.
What did he say? I love you, my father?
You killed my father, because he's doing the whole Princess Bride thing at the end. It was on The View, and he's being interviewed by the women on The View, and he's talking about how his full name, Oscar Isaac Hernandez Estrada.
Yes.
You killed my father, prepared to die. And
God, he's so cute. I love him so much.
My heritage is something I'm very proud of. So every chance I get, I do. Say, I'm Oscar Isaac Hernandez Estrada. You killed my father.
He's such a dork. I love him. I love him so much.
So first question. Would the presence of Oscar Isaac in the movie The Silence of the Lambs have made it a better film?
No.
Because you can't go up to 6 stars, first of all.
No, you can't. You can't go up to... You fucker. He's an incredible actor, and I would like to see his take on any of these characters, really. But I don't need it. I don't find it necessary, and there's nobody that I would actively replace. I mean, I have to choose a character to replace him with, and I understand that.
Right.
But I'm not saying, like, going into it, I would not be like, this movie would be better if Oscar Isaac was, you know, Hannibal Lecter or Scott Glenn or whatever. I cannot replace him with any of, you know, with any of those characters and have it be the same movie that it is.
But if you had to, question number two, which character would you have had Oscar Isaac play?
This is a tough one. I would probably pick one of the minor characters, like the bug guys. He could have easily been one of the bug nerds, especially a young Oscar, because he was such a cutie when he was in college.
I could see Oscar playing Bulldog's part.
Yeah, right. Or the guy with the cross eyes that she flirts with.
Especially like early Oscar Isaac work. Like he's just trying to get a job, and he'll just play whatever character you give me.
No, like,
I'm playing the bug guy.
For me, it's one of the bug guys. Maybe not Bulldog, because I love Bulldog so much.
It was fun. I had no idea it was him. But when you pointed him out to me, I was just like, oh my God, of course.
See, I love the chemistry that Clarice has with the cross-eyed guy and the way that she flirts with him.
Yeah.
And yeah, you could make that Oscar Isaac.
See, and that's the playful flirting that she knows is playful and respectful
and fun. Leans into
She leans into it because she gets it.
Yeah.
Whereas...
All the other disgusting men around her
that are doing the same exact thing are doing it in a gross way.
Yes, and she reacts kindly. Not that they should ever remake Silence of the Lambs, but if they did what they did for The Princess Bride, where they just had a bunch of people during quarantine, a bunch of different actors, take a scene and film it, and then put it all together, but they did that for Silence of the Lambs, yes, I would like to see Oscar Isaac in any of the roles, but I think that the bug guys is where he would be perfect at. And that has been this week's episode of Movie Mingle on Silence of the Lambs, and we hope that you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed bringing it to you. As ever, this is a fun and silly little podcast. We are so excited to have done 50 episodes. A lot of podcasts that start out like ours, rinky-dinky in a living room, don't last that long. And 50 episodes is absolutely something to celebrate and be proud of, and I'm very, very proud of it. Again, Caveman, thank you so much for your love, your time, your energy that you put into this podcast, all the editing, all the social media stuff. Just, you know, this podcast would not exist without him. So please, my loves, give him his flowers. You can praise him at moviemingle@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram and Letterboxd and Threads at moviemingle. And you can find us on YouTube at moviemingle. Next week, we've got Nope, which is how I felt about watching this movie for a very long time. But I'm actually quite excited to see it, because I think that my taste in movies has changed because of this podcast. And I think I might actually go into Nope with a more excitable eye. So we'll see how that comes. We'll see what happens next week. And then the following Saturday will be a special bonus episode for Caveman's birthday. Happy birthday, my love, where we are doing the director's cut of the awesome movie Kingdom of Heaven. And I know that usually awesome and Kingdom of Heaven don't go together in sentences, but I promise you the director's cut is legit. And I'm really, really excited to watch this again for my sweet husband's birthday. Thank you so much again. Feel free to rate us what we deserve on any podcast platform of your choice. Please tell your friends about us. Get the word out about Movie Mingle, because it may be a little thing, but I think that after 50 episodes, it's been made with a lot of love and a lot of joy. And, you know, we're doing the work. It would be nice to be rewarded for it, even just a little. So thank you for sharing the word, and please continue to do so. It means the world to us. Until next week, take good care of yourselves. Be safe out there. And if you're going to eat a liver with some fava beans, remember to have it with a nice Chianti. I can't do that well. But anyways, here we are. Okay, bye!
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Are you an effective team?
We are an effective team.
Let them fight.
How did you just do that?
I'm a really good lawyer.
Here on Caladan, we've ruled by air power and sea power. On Arrakis, we need to cultivate desert power.
Welcome, Mr. Beach. What's that bar? I'm a little confused.
Well, we wouldn't want that, would we?
I don't
want
to brag, but I will. I was in the Avengers.
The Avengers?
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you. What is that?
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Doga. Doga. Doga.